Case number 211689, Shayla Mar Howard versus Livingston County, Michigan, et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes. Mr. Kaylee Henderson, Ms. Kaylee Henderson, you may proceed for the appellants.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Callie Henderson appearing on behalf of the defendant appellant in this matter. May I please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal? Your Honors, prosecutors are entitled to absolute immunity for breaches of their Brady and Giglio obligations. That has been clear. And this court, in this case, is now presented with an opportunity to confirm that they are also entitled to absolute immunity for their duties in fulfilling those obligations on the back end. That would include reviewing, acquiring evidence to determine whether they have a disclosure obligation, and then presenting that information to the employer of that witness.
Did you raise this argument below about Howard's credibility?
Yes, I did. I do believe we did, Your Honor.
Where? Just so I know.
In our district court brief, this was argued that, and if I can pull up my district court brief, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't have the reference off the top of my head, but I do believe we did present this argument that they had obligations and these were prosecutorial in nature that they had to fulfill.
Okay, I trust you. I can go check.
I apologize, Your Honor. Perhaps while counsel is arguing, I can locate that specific page number for you.
Well, you're talking about absolute immunity, and I just want to sort of get to the heart of this. You argue for absolute immunity in a case where the prosecutors were basically conducting an investigation, they were conducting an investigation to determine probable cause for bringing charges, and this would seem to be outside of the normal prosecutorial function and getting into some of the investigatory or even executive functions. How does this conduct come under the purview of the absolute immunity provision or rule?
Yes, Your Honor, I hear your concern that what they were really fulfilling here was an investigatory role, which in the past the Supreme Court has recognized. Doesn't matter, it's the function that would be not entitled to absolute immunity, but I believe that is different than what was occurring here. This wasn't an investigation into whether there was probable cause to initiate charges like we would see, like we have seen in some of the Supreme Court cases where they're advising a police officer as to whether there's probable cause. That's not what we had going on here. And plaintiff's allegations acknowledge this as much. Here, plaintiff was an ongoing witness in cases that the defendants were presenting, in so much as she complains that she was willfully left out of proceedings in June of that year.
The way Judge Donald's breaking it up, and I agree with her, is one is prosecution. Clearly you get absolute immunity. Second's investigation. The only time you might get absolute immunity is when, as you've posited, you're investigating a potential witness so you don't suborn perjury in front of a court, which prosecutors have an obligation not to do. But the problem here is, aren't we here on a motion to dismiss? And when you look at the complaint, I don't see that. Maybe you raised it, but am I right? We're here on a motion to dismiss.
Yes, you are right. We are here on a Rule 12b-6 motion to dismiss.
So then I look at the face of the complaint. And does it say in there they were investigating me for that purpose? Or does it just, the complaint makes it sound to me like they're investigating her in retaliation for claiming there was discrimination by the prosecutors?
Your Honor, I would posit that those are the conclusions that she has drawn from the facts that she has stated. But when we look at the facts as they have been alleged, the facts are that she testified at a hearing in March of 2017, In June of 2017, she complains that they specifically excluded her testimony in regards to the probationer at issue from the March hearing, and then that they reviewed the transcript and the video of that March testimony, and they got copies of her notes in regards to that probationer.
And I'm not clear when, but in paragraphs 14 and 15 of her complaint, she says that the prosecutors misused their discretion in a discriminatory manner, and she's alleging that occurred before, I think, the investigation begins.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think we can make this assessment here based on the facts that she has alleged, because the analysis for absolute immunity turns on the function and we assess the nature of the actions that were being taken. We don't look at the intentions of the individuals in taking those actions, and we don't look at the consequences
coming from
that. Aren't you asking
us to look at the intentions? You're saying the reason they investigated, their intent was to avoid suborning perjury.
That would be a permissible intent, yes, Your Honor.
But you just said we don't look at intent, right? So I'm trying to figure out where I get the prosecution point. I think we all get the prosecution point. What we're talking about here is when do you get immunity? You're asking for immunity to be cloaked on an investigatory phase. And we all agree that that's a very rare thing for prosecutors, that they get absolute immunity on an investigatory phase. Maybe if they're trying to avoid suborning perjury, and maybe that's what they were doing, and that comes out in summary judgment. What I'm asking is, how do we do that on the complaint when her pattern that I read in the complaint is complain about discrimination and then investigation? And there's no allegation in her complaint that I lied or did something that necessitated an investigation.
Correct. Your Honor, I see the distinction that I think the court is struggling with. And I think focusing on the functional analysis of those actions, which I know I've already said, but perhaps give me a minute to flush this out, but perhaps by focusing on that functional analysis of the actions that are being alleged that the prosecutors took, that she complains about, that permits this court to say, yes, the prosecutors, this is a reason, as this court stated in Stockdale, there is a reason here as to why these actions would be taken in the context in which they're being described. And Stockdale looked at the timeline of the actions that were being taken. And here, the timeline that the plaintiff has presented us with clearly falls within a prosecutor's Brady and Giglio obligations, such that the letter is being sent prior.
How so? Because she complained about discrimination. There's no allegation here that anything was going on that, with respect to her, that needed to be investigated, or that the prosecutors had an incentive to investigate her. But after she made this complaint, it seemed that this, based on her allegations, which we are supposed to, the trial judge rather is supposed to assume as true for purposes of the litigation, it seems that after she made those complaints of discrimination, it is that triggered the investigation of her. And even we look at the bases on which a prosecutor can conduct this investigation and still be entitled to immunity, it doesn't fall in there.
Your Honor, I hear there's some concern from the court as in regards to the intent, and that she is alleging that all of this was done without probable cause. But by her very own allegation, she acknowledges that she was bound over. There is a determination of probable cause by an independent, either a magistrate or a judge, in where she alleges that one count was dismissed following the preliminary examination, but she was bound over on other charges that were ultimately later dismissed.
Tail end of the time frame, and your problem is that that this began in March, and the investigation continued, and in June of 17 she was intentionally excluded, and then in August of 2017. That was when the letter was sent to the plaintiff's supervisor. You know, if there had been knowledge that she committed perjury, why was no action taken on that knowledge before you send a letter to the person's employer to try to place her job at jeopardy?
Your Honor, I think the facts here as alleged acknowledge that there were, and I think that's what she's complaining about, is that there was an investigation undertaken, that they obtained the video of her transcript and they reviewed that. She alleges that the hearing in March happened, and then she was excluded from the June hearing, and then they obtained the transcripts and everything to review that, and then sent the letter to her employer in August, which falls squarely in line with what this court complained that the prosecutor didn't do in Stockdale.
The problem with Stockdale for you is it's a summary judgment motion case. I mean, that is the complete answer to Judge Thapar's question, is why does this differ? This differs because you're on a motion to dismiss. And you have to take all of the allegations of the complaint as true and make the inferences of fact in the favor of the person making those allegations. That's not Stockdale.
Your Honor, I acknowledge that. I acknowledge that there is a difference. And here, that's where we are accepting the allegations of fact that she has put forward as true. And those allegations support a timeline.
Sorry to interrupt, but let me read you this paragraph. Paragraph 20 of her complaint, that despite defendants' investigation revealing that plaintiff's testimony was truthful at the March 23rd hearing, or March 23rd, 2017, and knowing that she had not committed any crime whatsoever, Valancourt requested that the Michigan State Police conduct an investigation into whether plaintiff committed perjury. So, I mean, accepting that as true, his knowledge is she did nothing wrong, and yet they're doing this anyway. And so why can't we logically infer that they're doing it as a result of her discrimination? The other thing is Stockdale found no absolute immunity, right? They found qualified immunity. And right now we're just talking about absolute immunity.
Yes, Your Honor. You're correct as to what Stockdale found, no absolute immunity. And I think that was because that case was factually distinct from this case and that the timeline varied so significantly, whereas there the prosecutor was taking a lot of personnel actions before there was even any suggestion that there would be any implications as to perjury or Giglio obligations that she would have to disclose. Whereas here, the concern of perjury is what's being alleged from the very outset that they are supposedly saying that they are concerned with. And that paragraph that she acknowledges there.
I'm struggling with that. You're losing me on that argument because I'm struggling with your characterization of the timeline. She was cleared by MDOC. She was cleared and found that she was not disciplined in any way. So the letter went to her employer attacking her, saying, here's what we're going to do, here's what we're not going to allow. MDOC Internal Affairs does an investigation and finds nothing that's wrong. It is after that they then proceed to continue with an investigation. And I think the issue on absolute immunity is clearly that there's all these investigation steps taken before there's any prosecution. But the timeline itself fits within her allegations of retributive action.
Well, I think the timeline is actually that after sending the letter, MDOC does an investigation and is cleared. I don't know that there are any specific factual allegations that their investigation continued, but it's the fact that charges were brought after that. And I think the district court has already decided the bringing of charges, they are entitled to absolute immunity for. And all of these other actions, it's our argument, are directly related to that judicial process, not only before the court in bringing those charges, but in having to present her as a witness in the violation cases that she acknowledges in her facts that they continue to prosecute because she complains that she was excluded from those proceedings. Such that when we look at the actual nature of what they're doing, deciding not to call her as a witness, communicating that she will not be called as a witness because of her credibility, That's the specifics of the letter. And that's what allows this court to analyze the function that these two defendants were fulfilling, and that it was prosecutorial in nature and intimately related to the judicial process.
Okay, but you talk about her credibility, but they did not find that in their investigation that she lacked credibility. Also, they barred her from coming into the offices, correct?
Yes,
because
the
prosecutors. They weren't, yes, okay. So those things would tend to support the other factors that have already been mentioned that supports her complaint at the 12B6 stage. Because you continue to argue, I think, that your analysis takes you beyond the 12B6 examination of the four corners of the complaints and the allegations in there and the inferences that we're permitted to draw from those. You seem to be going sort of beyond that, and I think you're not there yet, because there's been no depositions or whatever to get beyond that facial examination for the 12B6 motion, and I'm not sure how you get there at this juncture.
Your Honor, I see that my time is concluded. May I briefly answer?
Please.
Yeah. I don't believe that I'm asking the court to go beyond the allegations of the complaint, as the allegations of the complaint plainly state that Defendant Valancourt's letter was about her credibility, her presentation as a witness, and those decisions, regardless of his intent, which the case law says this court must set aside his intent, are prosecutorial in nature in the evaluation of a witness and the evidence that is being presented to a court. And that is why at this stage the court can grant him absolute immunity for those decisions. Thank you.
You may remove your mask from the podium.
Thank you. I get so used to having it on, it becomes like a suit coat. Thank you, Your Honors. Good afternoon. Sean Cabot on behalf of the appellee. May it please the court. As this court is aware, and as during the prior discussion here this afternoon, this is about whether or not the district court correctly denied absolute prosecutorial immunity in this case. And what this case kind of boils down to at this point is really, what hat is the prosecutor wearing? It's kind of like a hat case almost. Are they wearing an advocate hat? Or are they wearing an investigator or an administrator hat? And depending,
you agree they can get absolute, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you agree they can get absolute immunity for some investigatory processes, correct? I mean, your friend is right that they have an obligation not to suborn perjury and investigate and disclose if they believe that is occurring.
Very limited circumstances. And my reading of the case law is that they can only get the absolute immunity once probable cause has been established in the case.
Okay, so if I'm a prosecutor and I believe my witness is lying, whether it be a probation officer or a police officer or any law enforcement witness, you're saying they can't investigate that and get immunity?
Well, there's already going to be a case in process at that point. And in this case, there's...
No. What do you mean? There's a prosecution. They prosecute people regularly.
Mm-hmm.
They have police officers who come to them and probation officers who come to them with allegations of violations.
Mm-hmm.
And they trust those allegations usually to get an arrest. If they believe one of them is lying and they have to investigate it, you agree. They get absolute. I'm not saying that's this case right now, but I'm saying, are you disagreeing that that carve-out exists for investigations?
I think there is that carve out in very limited circumstances that's not at all applicable to this case. And because in this case, we have a situation, this kind of goes back to one of the questions, Your Honor, that you talked about, looking back at the motion that defendants filed here about, was the issue of credibility raised? I don't believe it was. In fact,
forfeit the forfeiture by not bringing it up in your brief too?
Well, it's their motion, so.
No, I mean on appeal, you didn't raise forfeiture. right?
We did raise forfeiture, but...
I mean, it's goose gander, right?
I don't
forfeit the forfeiture, we've said.
I don't think so, because, you know, now they're making the big credibility arguments, they're making the big Brady arguments.
And why not bring up forfeiture in your brief, and then you win on that issue?
Well, that wasn't raised in lower court. I mean, they didn't even mention Brady.
They raised it here in their brief.
Well, and then
you didn't say it was forfeited, right? Am I accurate or am I missing something?
I believe you're correct on that, Your Honor. But again, we're responding to the claims that they're making in the lower court, and for them to come now and all of a sudden make these new arguments is not appropriate. In fact, they didn't even cite Brady or Giglio in the lower court. So I think to bring it up now is a...
District court did not mention any of the either.
Correct. And so for them to bring it up now is totally outside of this court's appellate jurisdiction.
It's within our jurisdiction if you don't raise it's within our jurisdiction even if you raise the forfeiture, because we can excuse it, but you have an obligation to raise the forfeiture. Just like they have an obligation to raise it below. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
But I think where it really boils down to, Your Honors, and I know I've heard it from Judge Strange, and I think all three of you, this is a 12B6 motion. This is not a summary judgment motion. This is a motion where the case law specifically requires the court to look at the four corners of the complaint, make all reasonable inferences in the non-movement's party, which in this case is Ms. Howard. Because you're right, there is absolutely no factual development at this case because it's a 12B6. There's nothing. And that's why is that important? It becomes even more important, and I don't want to dwell too much on it, but the qualified immunity argument, because the courts have cautioned, and other decisions in the circuit have cautioned, that in a 12B6 motion, it is generally not appropriate to even discuss, much less grant the motion on the basis of qualified immunity because of the very factors.
Unless you can't point to a clearly established case under your own version of the facts. So what is that clearly established case?
Well, I think in this case we have...
Because Stockdale, in very similar circumstances, said it's not clearly established. How do you get around Stockdale?
Well, I think Stockdale, first of all, was a summary judgment case. And
but that's beside the point on clearly established, right? We have plenty of cases on motions to dismiss saying, look, the clearly established is easy for plaintiffs. All you got to do is you get to, the allegations are all in your ballpark, and then you get to point to a case and say, this is clearly established. Otherwise, the whole purpose of immunity is defeated. So what's the case, and how do you get around Stockdale, which seems right on point to me?
Well, I would argue Prince versus Hicks, which is we've cited in our case. It's a Sixth Circuit case.
That's a broad statement about First Amendment retaliation, right?
I don't think it's broad at all. It's dealing with much of the same circumstances as this case does.
Then, again, let me go back to Stockdale, because that's a recent case by our court that said you can't get around clearly established. So how do you do it? There they said, and there they were pointing to Fritz, and they said that's a private public when it's a public employee, it's even higher, so it's not close, whereas Fritz was close.
Well, again, I don't think Stockdale applies here because, again, we're mixing apples and oranges here. We're in a 12B6 motion. No. We have to accept the facts and the complaint as they're stated.
Wait, stop. I'm accepting the facts. Take all your facts as true. Right? What do you do with Stockdale had identical facts. They had police instead of probation officers. Same thing. And our circuit said, not clearly established, that they can't do this. Send a letter. Ask for the termination of the police officers in Stockdale. I didn't even see it discussed in your brief how you get around this case. I'm telling you, this case is a problem. And I tend to agree with you on absolute immunity, just to be candid. But on QI, you got a problem with this case.
Well, and again, I think QI is not the purpose of the 12B6, but I'll address your inquiry, Your Honor.
Because the Supreme Court's taken up QI on 12B6. You're saying you can't raise QI on 12B6?
I'm not saying that. I've said that the case law is very clear that courts have to be very cautious, extremely cautious, because of the fact there is no factual development at granting a motion to dismiss based on qualified immunity. And when we get into Stockdale, I think the critical thing here, and I know exactly what you're pointing to, without even saying it, you're looking at that part of the opinion where it says, you know, what's the prosecutor supposed to do when they looked at the precedent, and, you know, there's all these cases. There's plenty of cases that shows that the prosecutors in this case overstepped their bounds, and that would be the Prince case. Yeah, it was a 1999 case, has not been overruled, and it was also a 12B6 case. But I think the other thing, especially in these cases where these are very fact-intensive, I mean, obviously we're relying on the fact-intensive nature of the complaint in this case, but even beyond that, they're factually intensive, and I think one of the critical things in Stockdale is the fact that who requested the investigation? It wasn't the prosecutor. My understanding, it was that the city manager requested the sheriff's department to investigate this issue. And I think that's important because they're another entity, a non-prosecutor, the non-prosecutorial arm, is
commencing and initiating an investigation isn't a First Amendment violation.
Well, but in this case, I think what's critical is that because in Stockdale, they sat back a little bit. And we're dealing with multiple instances of lying, personnel-driven actions. You don't have all that in this case. You have a plaintiff who made a complaint about some discriminatory practices who immediately they went after. This issue...
Let me hone in just a little bit on the substantive due process claim under mm-hmm. the 14th Amendment. That's count three, I mm-hmm. believe. We have a pretty tough test from Quinn about the factors that must occur. The stigmatizing statement must be made in conjunction with the plaintiff's termination from employment. You know, the district court looked to a Ninth Circuit case for the professional blacklisting, but there's not an allegation of blacklisting, is there? What makes, out of the various claims that have been pled, what saves the substantive due process 14th Amendment claim?
Well, I think what is one of the primary functions of a probation officer's job is to advise the court of what's going on. If there's some type of violation that occurs with an order that's in place, to advise the court, to obviously testify truthfully, things like that. That, I mean, essentially your job is to be the court's outside eyes and ears, so to speak. And so obviously with the court's reliance on that, the court is absolutely relying on that probationer to be truthful. And so when you send that information out there that they essentially are lying, absolutely that's stigmatizing. Absolutely that's blacklisting, because now, because especially in this case where there was no proof, now you've blacklisted this person when there's no proof of that. Because their essential function, the basis of their job.
Case that there would be a substantive due process claim here?
Well, I believe we cited it in our brief on what that was, but the elements are met. You have to have a deprivation of a constitutional right. We certainly have that because it dealt with the deprivation of her reputation, her good name, her honor, integrity, protected interests under the 14th Amendment. We have that. And we have whether or not the action shocks the conscience. And I mean, there certainly can be no more conscious shocking behavior than what's exhibited in this case. For them to go from investigating this because of her complaints of the discriminatory practices of the prosecutor's office to then get videotapes and get transcripts and then still without any proof. Because here's the thing, here's the, you know, we talk about timeline, and the timeline in this case is very interesting, because it would seem to me that once these prosecutors did their investigation, if there was probable cause that she was lying, it would have happened right away. They would not have waited till January of 2018 to issue an arrest warrant. They would have done it immediately. They didn't do that. Why? Because there wasn't any such evidence, or there wasn't any probable cause. And then so you go with this no evidence of probable cause. Then, as Judge Strantz, you know, I think you've mentioned the timeline. Then we get to June 2017. She's excluded from the hearing. Totally not even invited to attend that, participate in that, even though it was her probationee. And then August of 18, 2017, of course, we have the letter saying basically she's a liar. Again, still no probable cause. Then we have this investigation.
I don't dispute any of that. The behavior here was wholly inappropriate. But the question before us is a whole variety of claims. And I'm just asking you very specifically about the substantive due process claim and the general requirement of stigmatization in relationship to a termination or a blacklisting. And I'm just struggling with whether that's been alleged here or whether there is other Sixth Circuit precedent that would make someone, she's still working, right?
She is now. She was dismissed for a period of time without pay. Okay, so you have that period of time that she wasn't working. And I'm going to be careful with what I say, because now we might be getting into things that will be disclosed, I assume, through discovery, who this letter was sent to. But I don't think it just went to the MDOC. And so once discovery occurs, then it becomes very clear that that she gets a negative view from anybody. I mean, any judge is going to see this letter and think, wow, can I believe
the arrest,
her? So it has this.
Is the arrest, the fact of the arrest, still on her record?
To be honest, Judge Donald, I don't know. I do know that it's always going to be there forever. You know, it may. You know, I know Michigan, you know, you can get a Michigan State Police, I don't know what the form of the word, I'll call it a rap sheet.
Is there stigmatization based on the fact of her having been arrested?
Absolutely, because it's always going to appear that she was arrested. Now, there could be or charges brought for perjury. And again, maybe I don't mean to demean it, but maybe if you owned if you were a dog walker, perjury wouldn't mean too much. But if you're a probation officer, that is huge. It's almost, equivalent to a judge, how horrible that would be. And so, yes, in here, it may say charge dismissed, but the fact that she was arrested and charged with perjury never goes away, and that stigmatization for her job relies.
Does the timing matter? It was what, a year and a half? It was August of 19 before her motion to dismiss and quash the perjury charges. So you're saying that the time frame from the charge in January of 18 to August of 19 is an important component of the stigmatization?
I think that, and to the present day. I think to the present day it's an important element of stigmatization, because that fact, the fact she was arrested for lying, never goes away, ever. Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honors, I will be brief on rebuttal. I do want to first address Judge Thapar's question raised in the beginning, where I didn't have an initial answer for you. I fully acknowledge that the issue wasn't as clearly fleshed out in the district court as it has been on appeal. I do believe our argument to the district court, though, was that Prosecutors are entitled to absolute immunity for assessing evidence and the evaluation of witnesses and what to present, and was more fully flushed out in the reply brief to the district court, which did discuss a prosecutor's duties and ethical obligations in regards to the presentation of witnesses and whatnot, and that can be found in our reply brief. As to, there's been a lot of discussion as to the consequences of the defendant's actions and their intentions in taking these actions, and I believe that strays from the analysis that this court is supposed to undertake in an absolute immunity analysis in analyzing the function that the prosecutor was performing at of the action that they took. We look solely at the action, not why they were doing it, not whether it caused employment consequences. We look at what they did. And here, the plaintiff has alleged what they did. They excluded her from a hearing. They decided not to present her as a witness. That is solely a prosecutorial decision in advocating on behalf of the people of the state of Michigan. They also sent a letter to her employer in regards to her credibility as a witness, stating that they did not find her credible. That is, again, another witness credibility decision directly of prosecutors.
I'm struggling with how that's directly related to what's going on in this case, since that was at a time before they had any information that would support that.
Your Honor, again, that is, when looking into that analysis looks at the intent to what they're doing, whereas whether their intent was solely to impugn her character, that doesn't matter. It is his decision, and I know it is not something that we all like, and that is one of the issues a lot of people have with absolute immunity, but the Supreme Court in Imbler recognized that we make this difficult decision to give prosecutors immunity, even when maybe they're doing something we don't like. It will protect the bad prosecutors, but it's also going to protect the good, to allow them to make those decisions as to who they're going to present to the court as a witness.
So you're saying
their credibility.
They can make a decision based purely on retribution or vindictiveness, and at the absolute immunity stage, we can't look at why they're doing it.
Yes.
Because that's, whatever they do at that point, absolute immunity.
Yes, as long as it is in their role as an advocate. And that's where Imbler drew that line. Is it?
But if we take that position, don't we have to just assume that for all purposes, the prosecutor, minister of justice, is an advocate?
No, I don't believe so. And I think that those are what the subsequent Supreme Court cases discussing Imbler and the limits of absolute immunity have analyzed. That when a prosecutor is making statements at a press conference or swearing as a witness to an affidavit as opposed to presenting, bringing the charges, there is a difference. But here, when it's evaluating witness credibility, deciding what witnesses to present, and conveying that information that they will not be presenting them as a witness,
The other leg of that, though, that you just said is, even if the prosecutor is making a statement that is vindictive, retaliatory, and retributive, that immunity cloak still applies.
Yes, as long as it is a statement in regards to their role as an advocate. Yes, it's
even
distasteful
if it
to swallow.
Even if it is a statement that they have made while investigating whether this person is in fact guilty of impropriety. So it seems to me that you have swept away the distinction that the law makes between investigative phases and prosecutorial phases. Must be intimately associated with the judicial phase of the criminal process.
And I think,
and you're moving just right back into the investigative stage.
Your Honor, I don't think it's entirely clear that Imbler meant to solely exclude all investigative actions, and I think this circuit has recognized that in the Supreme Court by expanding such actions to administrative tasks in Vandekamp, recognize that there are certain actions related to what will be advocacy before the court that may flow into investigative or administrative, but as long as they are sufficiently tied to advocating before the judiciary, then they are cloaked with immunity. And I see that my time...
Does that include advocating before the employer of the person you're speaking about?
If it is intimately related to that, their advocacy duties, then yes, Your Honor. And I believe here, where she is employed for this purpose...
What advocacy duties do they have regarding Ms. Howard's employer?
Here, Ms. Howard is employed to monitor probationers and is required to report the violations and testify in court regarding those violations. And defendants are required to rely on what she's saying and present that to the court, and they also would then have a duty to disclose any perjury or credibility issues in that advocacy, such that I believe those are sufficiently tied to their role as an advocate, Your Honor.
The case will be taken under advisement, and an opinion will be rendered in due course. We thank you. Those are the only two oral argument cases we have. The rest of our docket is on the briefs. You may adjourn court.
This honorable court is now adjourned.